Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Lawrence Hulse of Onward Opportunities for this big Christmas special. So a massive welcome, Laurie.
Good morning, Paul, and to all the listeners. And as always, a real treat to be on and talk about small caps, which we all love.
Yeah, well, it's fab to have you back on the show, particularly as we've had a lot of big news, actually, since we last spoke, not least the delayed budget, which you sort of like foresaw the consequences when we last spoke. And also now concerns over the UK economy, whether we're sort of like on the verge of going into a recession. So putting all that together, what's your sort of broad outlook for UK equities, particularly in your sweet spot of small caps over the next 12 months?
You're right. We came on earlier in the year pretty downbeat, which is slightly, you know, creating a rod for our own back as a UK smaller companies fund. But it's this grim reality, and we're definitely not coming back on today to say it's all over and the budget's out of the way and now we're sort of breaking of the clouds into sunny uplands, because the data is quite grim, both at the macro level, unemployment, PMIs for sectors like construction, and then at the micro level, I mean, a couple of the holdings we'll talk about today, some of our more sort of bulletproof businesses warned quite early in the autumn, and for us that was a massive bellwether of some of the pretty shocking, for example, construction PMI numbers to come. Frustratingly, it's generally been a year of comebacks, whether it's the FTSE 350 or sort of MAGA or, you know, Oasis or Gladiator 2. Yeah, a lot of things have bounced back from what was a torrid H1, including UK markets, which have been a lot better than the narrative. But our economy just has not. And the frustration is it feels like a lot of it is self-inflicted and we're sort of uninvited ourselves to the party. I think looking forward, some sliver of potential positivity is that bad news might be good news. And it's our turn for a dose of that phenomenon that the US got so familiar with in the QE era. And actually, if unemployment continues to creep up as we now expect because of some of the policy decisions this government is taking, if the economy continues to slow down because the consumer and businesses have been clobbered with extra tax draw out of their disposable discretionary spend, then we think the Bank of England might have to cut quicker than people are modelling. next year. And while that might be quite an ugly, grim H1, much like this year, that could then set us up in a world of where markets look forward. And if interest rates are nearer 3% than 4% towards the end of next year, you know, small caps, smaller companies are heavily geared statistically to lower or falling rates. And that might finally lead to some sort of sustained, I'm going to call it a recovery rather than a rally in UK smaller companies. And there's been glimmers of it this year. That's the big frustration with really, you know, the delayed budget and some of the decisions within it. Yeah, there's been glimmers of hope. We've had good runs in the stock market. We've even had companies doing some good things. And then they get hit with another, you know, whether it's the national insurance rise or dividend taxes or whatever it may be. Just every time, it's almost like a kind of whack-a-mole of positivity. And it's very, very frustrating.
Just two potential catalysts for next year. I'd just like to pick your brains on. First of all, in October and November, we had Calastone reporting significant record outflows of money from UK funds. However, that a lot of that was actually juiced up by people taking out 25% tax-free lump sums outside their SIPs. Now, that money must be now sitting somewhere, whether it's going to go into the economy or whether it's going back into shares. That's the one catalyst. And then the next catalyst, if there is a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia next year, how will that model as well? So what's your sort of thoughts on those potential sort of like, potential sort of green shoots for next year?
So on that first point, definitely think you're onto something, and would just layer into that, you know, my comments a moment ago on potentially falling rates, that just adds to this draw away of cash out of fixed income, out of SIPs, out of the sidelines, and perhaps initially into some higher yielding, safer equities, of which there's loads on the LSE at the moment. And that being the kind of first base of equity flows and an equity recovery. We know capital is a coward and it loves company. And perhaps just that's the first sort of steps towards flows recovering. Yeah. But so far the outflows have been painful, but correct. There hasn't been loads to get excited about over here other than prices. And of course, you know, as a value investor ourselves, or certainly with a value bias, you need more than price. Otherwise it's a value trap. You've got to have the catalyst, as you say. On that second point, I think some sort of resolution in Ukraine is, you know, first and foremost, good from a humanitarian perspective. I mean, it's pretty grim, kind of modern warfare in the grimmest sense, and some of the things going on there. From an economic, from a markets perspective, it can only help sentiment. I don't think either energy flows and prices in Europe or the sort of peace dividend is coming back in its entirety, because I think the world has changed off the back of that. And what you're going to have to end up with in Eastern Europe is a kind of North-South Korea kind of iron divide, effectively, to prevent anything like this happening again. And that will have costs. And I also just don't think, therefore, the Germans or really anyone will allow themselves to become dependent on cheap Russian gas again. So I think it's more of a sentiment story than anything sort of a kind of fundamental return to former glories in the European economy. And, you know, Europe and the UK have some quite big questions to ask themselves. There was a pretty horrendous chart I saw in the FT this week of Europe, the EU's share of global GDP. And it's just the kind of top left to bottom right, the kind of chart we hate. And the most worrying thing is, whilst it's coming down, the forecast is just this really painful linear continuation, which tells you nothing is being done properly about it. And it's sad to see, because some of the best known, best companies in the world were and still get founded in Europe and in the UK. I mean, the UK in particular has a great track record on unicorns and global brands.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, your record has been pretty good as well since you started Onward Opportunities. And I know you're a really astute sort of stock picker. So let's run through some specific stocks. Let's start with one in the software sector. We've got Pebble Beach Systems, which is a sort of software provider for live TV play out, largely for sort of like traditional linear TV, but seems to be, as you mentioned last time, increasingly going into the streamers who buy live rights to maybe the NFL and people like that. Can you take us through your latest views on that? The shares, since you've highlighted it to everybody, in fact, have doubled. So well done.
Well, look, for that reason alone, it's a nice one to start on. But yeah, actually, more importantly, this is our bread and butter and where those strong returns of ours you've kindly referenced have come from. Our NAV is up about 50% now since we launched the fund in the dark days of March 2023. And stocks like Pebble are really the key to that. And what I mean by that is a small business that's actually a world beater at a really attractive valuation, and we can help the business do something about that. And then, so to run through that in the case of Pebble, at the time of investment, I think the market cap was 9 or 10. It's nearer 20 now. And that is a small company, but I don't know that many £10 million businesses that work with Paramount, Amazon Prime, Nvidia, another one that's a fruit that I can't technically probably name, but you know, some of the best businesses in the world, the magnificent ones. And here's the little Pebble. And that's what caught our eye when it popped on our screens at a kind of miserly 5x PE, 2-3 something EV, EBITDA. The reason why it was trading at such a low valuation is what you flagged there, the broadcast market. So just to remind listeners that are new or dining for the first time in the Christmas break, they have a software that allows broadcasters to line up programs, content, effectively. It's called linear broadcasting. So almost like, you know, that the sort of Sky TV, you know, all other good TV platforms are available, but the kind of Sky TV Planet or TV Guide, it was called, you saw things literally in line, and it was Pebble's system. It is Pebble's system that slots those programs and adverts together. As we all know, and it will come up later on another investment of ours, we're changing the way we all consume media. So we spend less and less time watching TV that way, and we listen to things and stream them and read them, and it's very digital and online, not linear. Oh my God, Pebble doesn't have a business model one day. Shares trade on that low. Multiple. We did, though, think that perhaps that was a, you know, as you often see in small caps, a bit of a cigar, but opportunity where this product would be required still for some time in some form, and it had very attractive 30% margins. So actually was 5-6x PE the wrong price, even in that context, and we could harvest some value, even in a kind of return of capital type format. That work, the due diligence you referenced earlier, we started talking to people in that TV content world, and we sort of struck upon us that actually, whilst the streamers are dominating and their broadcast is not linear, you stream a series of Landman or whatever it is, that's what I'm watching at the moment, they are now pivoting into live events to try and differentiate and expand their offering. And of course, if you're watching the Formula One or the Six Nations on Amazon Prime, that is linear. And all of a sudden, Pebble has got the chance to grow again and grow with some of the biggest, best known media businesses in the world. And we're seeing that start to come through in a more upbeat tone from the company, a better set of earnings expectations, a cracking update at the half year that drove that share price appreciation you cite. And we think there's more to come here, because after that move, it's still on 8 or 9x PE. If the business can grow again with that 30% margin as a software business, we all know that should be a double digit sort of PE number or a high single digit EV EBITDA number. And it's currently on, you know, sort of 5 and 10 respectively. What we've done to help the business along that way is almost encourage them to go for this as a new large strategic shareholder, push them to really not worry about trying to differentiate themselves and reinvent themselves, actually go back to what you're good at and get focused on selling it internationally. And, you know, a quick peruse of their LinkedIn page, you'll see they're super, super busy helping new and potential customers at exhibitions and things. And yeah, this is one we're really excited about next year, as the chance to both re-rate, grow its earnings and start returning some cash. It throws up about 3 million of cash per annum from memory. The market cap is just shy of 20 today. Well, if they pay back a third of that as a dividend, it's about a 5% yield. If they pay back two-thirds of it, 2 million, it's a 10% yield. So you could get this really attractive income and growth story at the same time. And as I say, one we're pleased with and are encouraged by. I've just met the new chair a couple of times in the past few weeks, and good to see him buying shares recently.
Mm. What's the sort of like consolidation opportunities in this industry? Because you'd have thought a lot of the old traditional linear TV will already have their playout software. And obviously, you know, some of the biggest streamers will also have their playout software. So if you want to grow, whether it's going to be Pebble Beach or another provider, you grow organically and then chop out the overhead and get 80% gross margins, and it's happy days.
I think Pebble has a number of options. Being candid, you know, one might have been to explore the business being consolidated itself. But given the opportunity in the market to go for growth, we're very much in favor of some organic growth ourselves over the next 2 or 3 years. Whether they should bolt some things on to add scale, discuss, it would help with the overhead, but it might also sort of diversify the quality of the offering. So let's see what the new chair decides. He's only been there a few weeks. But this is definitely one that we think to run for growth and a re-rating. And is definitely, if someone wants to own more of the broadcast and media value chain and go up it in the supply chain, this is a way for someone at some point to come knocking, we think.
Brilliant. Okay, well, let's stay in the software and technology sector. Let's talk about a company we've never actually covered at all before. So I tip my hat to you there, Laurie. You're always sort of like putting forward some businesses that nobody's ever seen and turning a few rocks. It's iTim, which is basically an end-to-end sort of like technology software company for retailers. Obviously a difficult spot at the moment. Roughly around about 15 million market cap. What sort of investment thesis here?
So this is one that we discovered this year, as you say. It's one of those ones you find on a quiet Monday in your home office going through the screens. It's screened interestingly on a valuation ground. Again, this is a software business, albeit break even rather than massively profitable like Pebble. Trading on, I think, about 0.5 times sales, 2.5 times EV/EBITDA. So again, very cheap, but small. So part of that is warranted, although not quite this valuation discount. To introduce the business to listeners, given it's not been covered before, iTim does something we think is really useful. So it has a software for retailers to help them improve their cash flow dynamics and improve their margins. I think if you talk to any retail business, they would say there's both things they want to do, especially at the moment in a world of Rachel Reeves and everything else. But this is a classic case of a solution without a home, or the importance of an ability to sell a product and the customer's own situation as much as the business itself. The product is great, makes a lot of sense, works well. The customers they've got love it and are very loyal. The trouble iTim have got at the moment, and where we're slowly building a position this year to maybe try and help them unlock this, is their customers basically have no money. So ironically, at the time you perhaps need a solution like iTim most, i.e. you really most need to improve your cash flow and you really need to most improve your margins, is the time you don't want to be spending any money on a new snazzy system. And this has been a bit of a kind of feedback loop for the business. It has got good customers. It does sort of 14, 15 million of sales at the moment per annum. What we're trying to experiment with them is a different sales proposition or sort of billing dynamics, so they can unlock what is they've got a great pipeline. It's well documented, it's in the accounts, in the slide deck, but get customers to convert and sort of pull the trigger in what is a difficult time for retailers. We'll talk about a couple of retailers later today. It's an undeniably hard market, but if we can help these guys unlock their sales techniques, unlock the pipeline, this is a really exciting business that should trade on 1+ sales versus 0.5 today. And you start to see how you can double your returns from our sort of entry price around here. Founder led, so we'll need an exit one day as well. But you never want to do that on the back foot. And so therefore, it's crucial to help this business basically find more customers like the entertainer, where they can do them a great job, build them, you know, 1-2 million pounds per annum, and you don't need to win loads of those to really move the needle on a turnover number of 15 today. So a slow burner is going to take time, but we need that time to get some liquidity in the stock ourselves, because it, yeah, it's a small business itself.
So one thing, which you know, doesn't sort of like for a software company, its gross margins are 40%. That, well, that says to me either there's a lot of sort of personnel content in that cost of goods sold, or alternative, they're selling third party software. What's the reason for the 40% gross margins?
You're half right, and I'll share the other half. So the business is definitely personnel heavy, because retail businesses change a lot. They typically have thousands of SKUs, thousands of products, and they're very often changing prices, changing supplier. There's a lot of variables. So actually the product offering for the customer has to evolve almost constantly. Combined with that, there is project-based work in the business at the moment, which is lower margin because it's more of a service than a software. And this you've really pulled on here, we think, is part of the potential answer for the business and what we're engaged on. You know, is services and billing and lumpy upfront projects and almost having a massive upfront cash call to a cash-strapped customer the right way of doing things? Or have we got to push it out towards a more linear, blended, smoother sort of almost sort of cash call on the customer over time? And I don't really want to sort of go into more detail at the moment than that, because you know, we're a shareholder, the business is founder-led, we're working with them to try and unlock this. And I sort of don't want to run before we can walk or over, you know, step on anybody's toes. But definitely an opportunity to unlock value and change things. And that's what our strategy is all about.
Is it all their software then? That's what you're saying. So it's basically personal and project related that brings the gross margins down. It's not, they're not selling third-party software.
Correct. And it's the Profimetrics module that we really like, and we actually think that should be the name of the company. It's a fantastic kind of bit of branding, and that's where the value is, we think. So good. Yeah, to answer the question, yes, it's all theirs.
Okay, good. Well, we had a pre-question. We've got Steve asking about Fintel, which is basically all things sort of like financial services for IFAs, intermediaries, product distribution and information. It owns sort of like two iconic names, or three in fact now, De Facto, Simply Biz, and I think it bought 360. It's on a buy and build strategy. It seems to have gone from strength to strength operationally, but the shares, incredibly, I was just looking at it, have gone down, which is, anyway, it is, you know, it seems quite a sort of like head scratching. Trades at about 14.5 times PE for a high margin recurring revenue business. What's been happening, and what's the attraction?
So in terms of what's been happening, it's that comment you've brought upon at the start of the call, flows. If you go and look at their share register, this is one of those businesses that is loaded with basically forced sellers. From outflows, when you have outflows, you sadly sell, in a fire sale, you sell the things you can sell quickly and easily. It's usually the better, more liquid companies, ironically. And we think Fintel, well, you can see it from the TR1s, it is a victim of that. This could go on for some time. We don't think the flow picture of some of these shareholders is necessarily improving. Just look at the Calastone publicly available data you talked about at the start. So this is one to monitor for now. You know, that it's a bit like one of those other charts we talked about earlier. This is a top left to bottom right, and isn't really showing any signs of changing at the moment. So it's sort of one to monitor. I'm aware of some of the brands it uses, as I work in the investment industry myself, and it owns brands in that space. If I'm right, I think some of the old smart metering systems team, which was, you know, good stock for us in years gone by, now work there. So one to take a look at, actually, good spot.
Yeah. And then just in terms of sort of private market valuations, I just saw it trades at only just over 9x EBITDA. I mean, I thought these sort of high, you know, high recurring revenue stream platform software and services, particularly in sort of fintech, sort of go for around about sort of 14, 15 times.
I would agree. Certainly in years gone by. What I am noticing at the moment, not just on this stock, anything to do with data, and platforms
right.
in large markets is coming under a kind of scrutiny for a kind of AI technological change. So, and your acquaintance, or dare I say friend, Paul Scott, has been bang on about this for some time, calling them as short opportunities where, you know, yeah, I think just last night, Google announced they're experimenting with real estate listings. CoStar shares, one of the biggest companies in the world, highest rated, shares off 6.5%. You've got to think anything in this world at the moment, people are just don't know. And in some cases, they do know and are scared. And I just wonder if Intel is suffering from a bit of that as well.
Yeah, great spot. Yeah, great comment. Okay, good. Let's move to sort of like surveillance and CTV. We've talked about it before, Synetics. We've got Brian submitted a question on it, basically, just asking about your latest thoughts. Done pretty well, actually, sort of like, you know, winning sort of contracts. Anyway, how do you see it going forward?
They have. Yeah, Amanda Lander, the new chief executive who had to step up in tragic circumstances, has sort of come to the helm, as I say, at short notice and overseeing what we believe to be a record year. There was a unscheduled or pre-closed trading update earlier in the year stating that effectively. The shares, I think, have travelled and arrived. It has had a good year, as you say. But, you know, it's starting to get in sort of bargain territory for us again. I think they're on, from memory, about 9x PE, so an EV EBITDA of what must be sort of 6 or 5. It may be even lower, actually, because from memory, if the market caps about 40, 45 today, I think they're sat on 12 to 15 million of net cash. And actually, that gives them one loads of optionality, massive margin of safety, and warps that the PE valuation. So perhaps EV EBITDA is the right way to think about it. What we like is security surveillance is definitely a growth area. Sadly, there's a number of stocks that have been doing quite well out of this, effectively need to be more secure in a less certain world. You know, I'm thinking of things like ThruVision or Interseed, ones like that. That said, some of those stocks, and I suspect Synetics is in a similar space, there's been a lot of excitement. And actually, these big projects where the surveillance and security is required, like a large casino or an airport or a data center, you know, they're not thrown up in 6 months. They are multi-year projects of which the cameras go in towards the end and then the software goes in at the end. So they've had a record year, given all we've talked about with the way the world is. It's a UK business with global customers. You know, it's going to be a hard one to repeat. Perhaps that's why there's some of the valuation there. But again, at 9x P, EV, EBITDA of 5x, we think that's a good topping up opportunity and have been into a 5-year view where this business, I think the LTIP tops out sort of £6.50. And you've got sort of Bob Holt as chair, who I think has his fans and his non-fans, but I think everyone agrees he's very financially motivated, and that's why, as a chair, he insists on incentive package. We believe they'll get there. I think from recollection, you know, it's going to be a 5-year story, but that's how we invest over the long term. You know, the business actually doesn't have to do loads. On the profit front, it just has to keep growing and the valuation will follow. And you get, you know, from here sort of 50% profits growth over 5 years and a rating re-rating from 9 to 15x. That's your sort of combined double from 3 to 6. Very simple maths off the cuff. But that, you know, bulletproof balance sheets at the moment, I think, are important. Not all our stocks have them, sadly, but this is one that definitely does.
And what sort of like percentages of recurring revenues for the business, you know, of Synetics? Is it mainly sort of project, or do they get the ongoing sort of service line as well off the back of putting in the software and the cameras?
There is some ongoing. I think of it as a kind of third ongoing revenues business in the context of it being 50% software, 50% hardware. The hardware, of course, is not, you know, never going to be recurring. That is the cameras, the hardware going in. You then have the software following, and that is sort of split about, you know, 50-50 itself, slightly more in favor of recurring, hence that third number. And that's an area you can expect to you know, any rational management team, especially one with an attractive value creation linked LTIP, to be focused on, because we all know the market, investors, consolidators value recurring revenues and software revenues. And, you know, they are going to have to use that cash balance. We want them to use that cash balance. And that would be our vote of where to deploy it.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to sort of all things factory automation and high-speed packaging. We've got MPAC, about 100 million market cap. It was absolutely flying at the back end of, well, this time last year, having sort of like integrated a couple of big acquisitions. And then the Trump trade tariffs knocked 10 bells out of the manufacturing industry out in the US, particularly in sort of food and beverage and healthcare and pharmaceuticals. What's your sort of your latest on this one, as the sort of the world is now starting to readjust to the tariffs, and also Trump has put in the big beautiful tax bill with upfront tax incentives for factories to be built on onshoring?
This was the real kind of what might have been for the year. It was our one real sort of tariff victim. I took it quite, not personally, but, you know, I'm competitive. I care about our investors. I'm one myself. And it was a real frustration because this was a top pick at the start of the year. But, you know, in a nutshell, because we felt they'd acquired two businesses, one we particularly really liked and, you know, works with the likes of Fanuc, which are really great companies. So it came into the year with some new exciting earnings growth drivers. And the brokers, to be conservative, have modeled no synergies from those acquisitions, therefore a group margin of 9%. Well, they'd done 11 in H2 just last year. So we felt they could do at least that, if not maybe 12 or 13, because of the operational gearing that the acquisitions bought. So there's potential for a decent profits upgrade, just mathematically. And it, you know, it came into the year as Onward's largest holding. It isn't now. Because it's been whacked pretty hard, as that chart shows. We had taken profits along the way. We first spoke about this one on the podcast in 2023 with you, back when it was sort of £2, and, you know, we are still in the money today on our share purchases, and we did take profits at sort of £4.85, £5.50, really on waiting grounds, because the shares had swollen in the portfolio given the performance. But in hindsight, wish we'd sold them all, obviously, but, you know, no one knew what was coming with Trump. Look, I think, you know, positively, the business has weathered that storm. It's been a real, you know, real blow to the team, the business, but it's provided an opportunity to harden up. I think Adam, who we really respect as a CEO, as a business operator, now also really knows what it's like to run a public company in the most public of ways, i.e. a big profits warning, and everyone on his case as to why. I think they're stronger for it. As a board, we've helped engineer that. So Clive Wiley, who is a very well-respected, well-known turnaround recovery, sort of, I hate the term city grandee, but he's a great, great set of grey hairs to have going on the board of a small cap. He chose MPAC alongside one other stock out of quite a long list of things people wanted him to do, because he was excited about the long-term future of this one. This isn't, you know, he often goes into burning buildings. This isn't that. The North American division is troubled, and that's why we want him there, to help sort out that business and that large market. But Clive can really help the business also maximize what remains a long-term attractive structural growth story. You know, there are going to be less and less young people, and they're going to be more and more expensive to employ, especially in factories, in warehouses, and therefore these sort of robotized automatic packaging lines for us all to consume, because we're not going to be working anymore because AI is going to do all our jobs, is an area of excitement still. And reshoring, automation, packaging, consumption, all great themes to be plugged into. It is in the single digit PE club. We don't think the North American market is going to rapidly pick back up for them. That's just not how big ticket decisions are made. They can be cancelled very quickly because they're large calls. But to, you know, get that confidence back up takes time, because you then realize, well, you know, we're getting by with the old, you know, the old Mullins machine. It's a bit creaky, but it's working, and we've saved that 8 million. It's in the bank as to our own balance sheet. But we do see it sort of gingerly. It's definitely signs of stabilization. We hope that's continued through Q4. It was good to see Clive and some other directors buying shares earlier in the year. We hope to see more of that. And it's in that single digit PE club where I think it's on 8 or 9 times PE. Transactions for business like MPAC happen much higher than that. We don't expect that to happen anytime soon because it's in a nascent part of its own journey. But on a 5-year view, I think you'll look back as MPAC at about £3 as a chance to buy a 2 or 3xer. I think all the broker share price targets were about £9 before the Trump tariffs hit. High quality management, high quality business, and in a large structural market. So one we're going to have to be patient on, recover some of the paper gains that we've given some of them back. We did top up a little bit over the summer and the winter after the dust had settled. And, you know, a proper SMID cap potential here. Mm. We really like the service revenues in particular. It makes it more than just a kind of large project business. It is a project business. That's why it'll never be a 20 times PE business. But, you know, it's a good quality brand in its world, especially CSI palleting. That, you know, that's the one that works with Fanuc and others. That is something to keep an eye on. We think that's a real gem brewing there. There was a fantastic Substack on it by, I think it's called the Oak Bloke. Well worth looking up and reading. I mean, kind of, to be blunt, you know, institutional grade research, if not better, freely available to listeners. And that's not a recommendation. That's not a kind of validation of it, but just a passing comment that if you're interested in MPAC, that is well worth a read.
Yeah. You could argue, actually, sort of like that, you know, this is just a temporary pause because we haven't stopped onshoring into the US. In fact, if anything, the tariffs have accelerated. Plus, if there was an economic argument to put a factory or a new production line in the US before, then there's an even stronger one now. So what we should be doing is just, there's an argument to say, all we've done is basically push the orders to the right. Plus, a lot of big factory manufacturers are looking at M&A, you know, things like Rockwood, Honeywell, Siemens, and this would be something to add onto their, you know, portfolio, one would think anyway.
I think that's right. And I think from memory, actually, that Substack I mentioned, this was one of their comments that you just sat on, you know, a bow wave at work at some point that still has to be done. It's just, it has been postponed. You know, I don't think many people can argue the fact that, you know, automation is going to be required in the modern world, and reshoring may accelerate the need to do that at some point.
Good. Okay, well, let's move to all things podcasts. We've got one sort of like standout company on the UK market, Audio Boom, about 120 million market cap, all things sort of like, you know, publishing and marketing and advertising for podcasts and stuff. It's slightly smaller than the likes of iHeartMedia and SiriusXM and these sort of stuff, but they seem to be doing pretty well on the like-for-like side. How do you see this one going forward? I think, is it also under a bid, or it's going through a sales process as well at the moment?
Yeah, I, from memory, I think it's termed strategic review, and perhaps let's come on to that as part of the discussion. I'm just starting at the start. This is a business that I think the market, well, I don't think, the shares at 270 where we built our position tells you the business, the market struggles to understand and value at times, and it's definitely one of those ones that people debate what's it worth. And therefore, I just thought it'd be useful just to lay out where we see the value and why, to contextualize the discussion. So we talked earlier in the podcast, funnily enough, about linear broadcast and that world being in decline for the likes of Pebble. It's been in decline because people are consuming media other ways. It's splintering. It's available through so many different more portals and platforms, and one area of that has been podcasts. I don't know. I actually watch them on the telly now. You know, you can Spotify app, you can watch a bit of Joe Rogan or a bit of Paul Hill with your evening cup of tea. And, you know, I think Investor Meet Company, they put all their company meetings on there. So I find it a really useful way to, I watch more podcasts than I do telly, definitely. And it's kind of eating into, you know, versus what time I spend reading something like the FT. I now consume content through podcasts. Anyway, why is that relevant? Because that's just a nice to have for the consumer. That this is actually a good, well, we think a great business model with a competitive advantage versus traditional legacy media. So for decades, media, whilst cultural and nice and entertaining, the real nub of it is it's about getting our attention pool so people can advertise within it. That's the actual business. And that's where the money comes from to do it. And for years, it was expensive Hollywood productions, film sets, big broadsheet newspapers. You know, I reckon in its heyday that the Telegraph or the New York Times probably cost $1 million to produce a week or something, maybe probably more. And I know an episode of The Crown is about $10 million an episode to make. So let's say the New York Times takes an hour to read, and we know the episode of The Crown, takes an hour to watch, or Downton Abbey, or whatever you want to go with. Yeah, if they're multi-millions of pounds to get our attention for that hour, Paul, you know, at the moment, well, now, podcasters, which are becoming increasingly popular, they can produce an hour of content to advertise within just the same way, albeit a smaller audience, for a fraction of the cost. I reckon we could record a podcast for less than $1,000 and produce an hour of content. Okay, it's a couple of mics, bit of good quality cameras, editing. So what that means, the kind of mousetrap of podcasting, you can offer advertisers the same outcome at a much lower price, but still make a much better margin than a broadcaster or a news or broadsheet newspaper, which we know are all losing money in a structurally struggling business models. And what's even more compelling on top of that is not only is the cost lower, but actually the because you can really target the adverts based on podcasts of very specific content. You have a very specific type of listener, but actually quite often, and this is where the value of audio boom comes in, you can target the ad based on whether it's me that's downloaded it on my Spotify app or you, Paul, or Paul Scott, or whoever it is. And this is their ad rip and showcase systems where they are, you know, it's bespoke advertising to whoever's listening. And that has huge value to advertisers. And that's why this is a platform business that has lots of potential future value and certainly wasn't worth 0.7 times sales where we invested at £2.70. We actually think it's a sort of 2x plus sales business, either, you know, as a listed entity, or you'd have to add a kind of control premium to that in something like a strategic review that's going on at the moment. But the key thing is it's an area of structural growth with a cost advantage in very, very large markets. And it is a unique stock. It's in that gems amongst the rubble bracket, because if you don't have to agree with what I just said there about the advantages of podcasting as a business model, but if you do, well, you can go and buy Spotify. That's very expensive. Not as good margins as Audio Boom will make next year. You can go and buy iHeartMedia on the NASDAQ, but that's 6x geared. And okay, I'm not comfortable with that. Well, iHeartMedia is the number 3 in the US, and then Audio Boom's number 4. It's a net cash balance sheet. We think the business will do $9 or $10 million of EBITDA next year on a kind of turnover of 90 or 100, and crucially that will pretty much all convert to cash for the first time in about 6 years, because the business, and this has been the bear case, had been dealing with some onerous contracts where it effectively over promised to the podcast content creators in the past, basically underwrote their earnings. The last of those, spookily, I think actually it's the 16th of December, it runs out. So a lot of these adjustments and should come out next year, but also the cash balance should start going out quite quickly, which will allow them to start bolting on smaller catalogs of content that, you know, like the Adelicious deal earlier this year, which we really liked and funded, because smaller publishers don't have a showcase platform. They don't have the ad rip capability. So if you go and buy like an Adelicious's content book, there's obvious cost synergies from putting one small platform into a bigger one, but there's huge revenue synergies because you can monetize the back catalog almost instantly. Because I don't know about you, if I find a podcast I like, I then go back and listen to previous ones. If you don't have an ad rip type capability, all the adverts are out of date and the advertisers don't actually want to pay for that. If you can slot them in all the time as they are doing Audio Boom with both back catalog but increasingly video content as well. That's quite compelling as a kind of M&A bolt-on model, especially if it's self-funded into a platform. Drive the margins up, drive the growth. Now, all of that is exactly why we bought the shares, but also whilst it was a lot earlier than we dare hope, we weren't kind of totally gobsmacked when Mark Klieman broke a story that in, I think it was October, that Fox and iHeartMedia were considering takeover approaches for the business. Because for the same reasons that it's attractive for Audio Boom to acquire some minnows over here, well, Audio Boom, 100 million market cap, which it is now, I think, is a minnow to a Fox or an iHeartMedia, but there's obvious synergies. There is a lot of kind of media content deal flow going on at the moment. Gary Lineker's just sold his podcast platform done a deal on a really punchy multiple with Netflix. Netflix have also done a content deal with iHeartMedia. Audio Boom's slightly higher peer. Fox themselves bought a streaming platform called Tubi in 2017. Lachlan Murdoch oversaw that deal. He's now this year taking control of the entire Fox Corporation after a 5-year family succession style battle. They bought Red Seat Ventures this year, which is a podcast business. So there's loads of deals going on. Where the strategic review goes, it's with the gods. I think the last update was that proposals were expected in the next few weeks, but that was well more than a few weeks ago now. So we're you know, it's anyone's guess what's happening. It's still in the panel's disclosure table that comes out, I think, every afternoon or certainly every Friday. And let's see what happens. The business trades on 1.4 times sales today, so we're agnostic either way. We see ongoing upside. The core business, or the business, is trading really well. So if nothing happens, it's back to plan A. But plan B could deliver a kind of Christmas cracker like last year. I think we had Windward bid for on Christmas Eve. So there's form in the grotto.
What's the sort of the IPR for it? You mentioned obviously the technology, fine, in terms of it can place the ads and stuff like that. But I don't think it owns the IP, because I think it basically buys a lot of the IP from other people who do the podcast. Plus its networking effect. It gets its networking effect from distributing to Apple and Spotify, who must contribute most of its downloads, I would have thought. I'm just trying to work out what the actual inherent IP is. Is it the technology platform?
It's the technology. It's the relationships with the content producers. So you're totally right. And look, the reasons why Audio Boom's gross margin is 25 or 23, we think we'll get to 31 day on an organic kind of standalone basis. But the reason for that is, you know, half to two thirds of the advertising revenue goes to the content producer, and Audio Boom take the remainder in return for doing the publishing. And so the IP is the technology, really the showcase platform, the ability to chop and change adverts instantly, the relationships with the advertisers to have the content there to fill. And, you know, a lot of the podcasters at Audio Boom have been there a long time because there's a relationship there. They're looked after. They get a good service. You mentioned Apple and Spotify and the fact they are the platform delivering the downloads. Well, that's probably, you know, that's some M&A banker's probably rationale for buying Audio Boom, isn't it? Because you're just taking more of the wallet you're effectively creating. So let's see what happens. You know, the rankings in the US are Spotify, Apple, iHeartMedia, and then Audio Boom. So you've named all the kind of competitors there.
Okay, good. Let's stay in the same sort of like media sector, but go sort of like more traditional sort of advertising agency, the creatives. We've got the Mission Group, about a 20 million market cap. It has been through trials and tribulations, but I remember you talked about it last time, and they'd just recruited a new sort of like heavy-hitting CEO to join them to sort of turn around the actual business. How is that progressing? I know the valuation is extremely, extremely low.
So this is not a structural growth, IP-ridden media business. This is the opposite. This is a share price that contains deep, deep sort of intrinsic value. Some of the parts value. I think when we first talked about it last year, we said we believed, you know, the number of the agencies, there's five key ones. We thought there were three, each of which as a standalone was worth kind of the market cap. We've delivered on that statement. So the 1st of January this year, the business sold 15-20% of the profits for nearly the entire market cap. And you saw the shares really have a little run. You can see it there, and it's where it says 2025. They got up to 30-odd p from our entry price of 18. We were feeling quite pleased with the progress, proof of concept. We'd managed to deliver, the business had managed to deliver proof of concept on the thesis. But of course, in a small cap market of outflows and a tough UK macro backdrop that we talked about today, that's all been given up. You know, I think every media business this year, other than probably Audio Boom and Brave Bison, have warned this year.
Yeah.
You know, Saatchi's,
WPP,
System One, WPP. I mean, S4 perennially warns, but it did it again just for good measure. And, you know, earnings and trading is tough. But this is a business on 3x PE, EV, EBITDA of something similar.
2.5.
Yeah. The disposal at the start of the year was on 10 times. And we think there are other assets you can sell on 10 times. We are an active, engaged shareholder. We own north of 10% of the business. We like charts that go top left to top right, not the other way around. And that's what we're on a mission to do. And the new chief exec is definitely on a mission to do that with us. He's not a media man. And there's been some cracking case studies of how you really can extract value from these things. You know, almost, you know, same sector, small, similar time. Look at Centaur. Real great. It's taken a couple of years, but a real harvesting of value. It can be done. We believe it will be done here. And look, I think they're a December year end. I don't think it's been a cracking advertising spend world, citing all the profits warnings we talked about. But yeah, this could get crazy cheap versus the potential to dispose of assets. And look, that's what we've been buyers in the teens and happy when it goes up. And then we sort of top up when it comes down. We had hoped the advertising market would be better this year, no doubt. We thought they might be in a good place trading wise, but just those animal spirits have been doused all over, especially post the summer. I mean, they had a good trading update at the half year. You know, comfortable new client wins, some good names. But you know, this is what we talked about when I last came on. Yeah. Why would you push a budget out? You know, the UK economy is not renowned for delivering kind of upside surprises. So why run the clock down in the corner? They should just kick the ball out early. But deep value, special situation of which we're heavily engaged on.
Mm-hmm. Why was John Carey, the new CEO, what's his modus operandum? Is it basically to unbundle and sell off and realise value? And also, in terms of the creative industry, I mean, obviously there's a lot of concern in terms of generative AI. And I think Coke this year, they basically do a 20-year Christmas advert called, I think it's sort of like Holidays Are Coming. And they've done it totally this year with generative AI. And it's the top advert in the world, over in the States. And that's just totally generative AI. So you do wonder the sort of position of creative advertising agencies anyway. They're sort of like their seat at the table going forward. So it's two things in terms of why was he recruited? What's his objective? And also the sort of long term of the creative industry.
Without wanting to put words in his mouth too much, the business has got to dispose of things as a balance sheet that requires that, as a valuation, frankly, that requires that, because the market's telling you it doesn't believe the values. So you've got to go out and show it and deliver it. I think you get a different approach to cost management from a kind of non-evangelist. This isn't an example. It's a sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek thing, but you know, the aquarium in reception can go kind of thing. He comes from the world of BP, where, yes, they did a lot of work on PR and IR and advertising and branding, but that was, you know, a hard run business. And we expect to see that mindset come to disposing of assets in an unemotional way, running the remainder business in an unemotional way, and then coming up for air at some point when those first key phases are done. And there's a conversation to be had with what you do with the remainder, you know, much like a Centaur type situation. But John is energetic. He's done it because he sees a challenge in a way that he can, you know, he can directly, there's catalysts for management to take control of, and that's what presses his buttons.
Okay, good. Okay, well, let's move to rock drilling. We've got a pre-submitted question. Matt is asking about Mincon, which basically is all things sort of like construction, rock drilling, mining, rock drilling. And I think it also does geothermal rock drilling. It's been through trials and tribulations, but the shares actually in the last 6 months have taken off. So what's the sort of investment thesis here?
You had Richard Penny on, I think, a week or two ago, rather eloquently describing the business, why he likes it. What, you know, it sounded like we've been buying at the same time. So I'm not going to try and add to his dulcet tones on what the business does. But what I might just sprinkle in, what I might just try and add is our upside thesis on it, why we've been buying. So you're right, drill bits business, quite a lot of IP. If you go to Indaba, the big South African mining conference, you'll see Mincon everywhere. Well known in the industry, Irish business with a global presence. The reason why the profits and thus the shares have had a very difficult 3 years is that IP I talk about was basically copied by some Chinese low-cost competitors. The quality wasn't quite as good, but the price differential made up for it. And you've seen that in Mincon's falling gross and operating margins. That was combined with a slowdown in, you know, it's a familiar tune, isn't it? A slowdown in large capital projects like drilling requires. And that's seen the shares come from a high of about £1.50 to, I think they got as low as sort of 30. There's a London paper, an Irish paper. This is the London paper, I think. So I'm making sure I'm talking the right numbers. Yeah, there you go, 30. And, you know, we've been sort of buying whatever shares we can between not far north of that and about 46p, I think they are today. Why have we been doing that? Why do we share Richard Penny's admiration for the business and the shares? So if you read the investor decks, if you read the report and accounts, basically the two problems I've described a moment ago that saw the profits gone down appear to be being remedied. So from a end markets perspective, their own commentary has definitely picked up in terms of some of the somberness came out early in the year and a bit of upbeat spring in the step adjectives sort of started weaving in more recently. They had an update a couple of months ago. You know, and you don't have to take their word for it. You know, given this is a business exposed to global sort of construction and metals mining, well, the metals mining in particular is clearly in an upcycle. We think that is sustained. We think that is a structural thing. And therefore, Mincon's drill bits for metals mining should have a good sort of upcycle now of demand. The construction market, we don't see as strong, but Mincon's customers seem to be picking up. So I suspect that's just sort of gradually falling interest rates feeding through to some big projects and some government spending in parts of the world feeding through. You've got to be careful at times not to get too biased by dear Rachel and dear Keir over here, because, you know, Mincon sells globally and actually there is stuff happening around the world. It's just not here at the moment, unfortunately. So you've got that going on at the top line level. But I think what's most exciting for us as investors is they've got two products that are out now, which are kind of almost next generation. I hate the phrase. But, you know, replacements of those previous series of drill bits, which have basically been copied. We think it'll take the Chinese 5 years plus to get hold of them, copy them, prototype them, get them through the distribution network and try and compete again. And whilst that's going on, Mincon's going to be able to sell at proper pricing power again. And our sort of simplistic thesis, there's obviously work behind it, but for the sake of time here, margins recover from 6 back to kind of 13. They were as high as 15, 16, 17, but you know, we like to be a bit conservative. And with some higher turnover from some, you know, increased sales of these new products, which, especially Greenhammer, that seems to be capturing customers' imagination quite a lot. They've just won a really attractive first order. And that, if that works, that could lead to a lot of work. So not just in a market recovery, but proper organic market share gains. But either way, we expect, you know, turnover recovery to the 150 mark. That higher margin on higher turnover, in simplistic math, sees the profits treble, because the margin's slightly more than slightly double, and then you get some drop through in pound terms from, you know, that margin's on a higher turnover base. And yeah, the Mincon shares, I think our average in price is about 40, so halfway between the lows and where we are today. You can see that being a 3x if the profits triple. It's on the right rating at the moment, about 12, 13 times, but that's because people are starting to price in these prospects. Mm. So if you're seeing the rating stays flat, but the profits do triple, your shares should triple to boot. So we like this one. If there wasn't the large family stake, and if it wasn't sort of capital projects exposed, this would have all the makings of a core holding for us. It's in the nursery because of those reasons. But, you know, a 3Xer from some kind of fairly formulaic catalysts, basically, is super attractive. It's got a brand, it's got a balance sheet, trades at discount to NAV, profits can grow, end markets are improving. There's a lot to like there.
Yeah, and if there's ever a sort of like a ceasefire in Ukraine, there's going to be billions and billions, hundreds of billions who need to rebuild Ukraine, plus Gaza needs rebuilding as well. So that should, the global construction market, if those eventualities ever happen, that's all in for free. Okay, let's.
One thing I should just point out to this is there are two share classes. There's an Irish share and a London share. The London share trades at a discount to the Irish share. I think just because it has more, because it's an Irish company, it's better traded on the Euronext. But that's just worth flagging in case there's confusion.
Okay, good. All right. Well, we've got Drew. He's asking about Alumask, which is basically a building products company that makes fantastic margins. Actually, operating margins 10% plus. It's got a building products division, a building over envelope type business, and also rainwater sort of products and stormwater. The shares, actually, they came out with a little sort of like profit warning probably about 3 or 4 months ago due to the slowdown in the UK and delays caused by the budget and stuff. And the shares are now looking extremely attractive. But what's your view?
So I talked at the start about, you know, one or two bulletproof businesses that raised the alarm bells early. And one of them I was referring to was Alumask. So one of the things we loved about the business when we first spotted it in 2023 at about £1.50 a share was it was the only construction company we could find that hadn't had a profits warning post-COVID and had managed to increase its margins post-COVID. You remember we had that real kind of increase in it, raw cost type dynamic, and the air markets were rubbish. So, yeah, albeit it was a modest 7% downgrade, and they've gone early, credit to them. The shares are off, you know, nearly 40-50% I think now. Mm-hmm. So a harsh reaction, we think. But what that told us back in October was actually, oh god, the construction market's gone off a cliff. So because this is the first time they've warned in 6-7 years, and yeah, arguably post COVID was much tougher, you would have liked to think, than it is now. But we've gone on to see a construction PMI number come out that's frankly abysmal. 39.1, I think the number. Just that's like kind of lockdown type territory. You've had Christopher Mills, you know, eloquently but despairingly have to flag on podcasts like this, and I think he did one with the Mail on Sunday, you know, the costs being laid on building a house by this government are prohibitive, totally prohibitive. So the air markets have got tough almost at quite short notice, unexpectedly. If anything, we thought this might be a stock that would benefit from the current government, because they claimed they were going to build 1.5 million houses, and whilst we felt like that was a stretch target. We did think they would prioritise it because it's a vote winner, and that's ultimately what drives all politicians. And it's just not happened. I think the market perhaps is pricing in, have they warned enough with that 7% downgrade? And yes, at first glance, we thought, oh, that's not a big number, and it's early in the year. Are they kind of not quite ready to bite the bullet? But the company have reassured us that actually it's because they have spotted things early. They know, you know, the CEO is a 20-year veteran, Paul, who's done a really good job in recent years. He said, look, I've spotted it early. I've been able to flex the cost base to mitigate it. You know, on a ceteris paribus basis, yes, the downgrade would be more, but we're leaning into it with cost reductions. So for us, our fund's quite tight on cash at the moment because we've been investing. We've been busy bees. This is in the 8x, maybe even near 7 now after the past couple of days, P territory. Real bargain basement territory for us. And when we can, one we'll add to. We like the margins. We love the products. We think there's a huge opportunity internationally, which they've started to scratch the surface on. And with the Timlock business, when we do actually at some point build some houses, that is a highly profitable, highly operationally geared kind of hidden gem in the group, which could throw off, you know, a series of upgrades for the whole group. I'm almost nervous on this one because the pension is coming into surplus. It has brands we know people would value in the industry. That's how we got to really value the company. And at 7x PE, it's frankly vulnerable, and a change of chief executive going on. It's in this list of frustrations. You know, without the national insurance increase, without the delayed budget, you know, this is a business that would have not missed and maybe even upgraded this year because they hit their full year numbers in June despite the cost increases from the government. Well, that they obviously didn't know they were going to happen, so that tells you they were, without those extra $750,000 of costs, they were going to be a nice 10% upgrade. And then I do think this construction slowdown is undoubtedly delayed budget driven, bad policy driven, and, you know, last year's budget, they've admitted themselves, effectively was inflationary, and that's delayed the reduction of interest rates, which is a huge driver of construction activity and house purchasing mortgage activity. So again, in this kind of parallel universe bucket of what might have been, we've got another one coming up later on the podcast, I think. Mm. The government have got, yeah, everyone can see the problems. I think I slightly ranted on it yesterday. Everyone can see the problems other than apparently Whitehall. You've got to unlock activity. You can't beg, borrow and tax and from the gilt markets to prosperity. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I mean, it pays a 4.5%, 5% dividend yield to get paid to wait. And when the housing market does eventually turn, then it should be in a really good position because, as you say, it's on a really low valuation for a very high quality building products company. Okay, well, you've sort of like segued perfectly into one of the house builders that actually is bucking the trend, that Springfield, the Scottish house builders. Can you take us through this one? Because it really has done, the share price has done fabulous, actually, looking over sort of two years. I mean, it's more than doubled.
So this is one I've been talking to the listeners about from not long after we started onward. Probably sounded like a bit of a broken record for that. Yeah, there was an initial rally late 2024, but that was a really steep discount to NAV. I think the shares down there are at 50p of book value. They rallied to a kind of 90p average, and it sat there for 2 years. And we've been tearing our hair out collectively because that was still 0.75 of book value. And I've talked to the listeners before about how the book value was particularly interesting because it was a land bank with planning permission. It's a classic case of being a value investor and having to be patient. And it's now the market's starting to wake up to what we spotted, you know, some time ago at much lower share prices. And it's starting to translate into healthy returns, and you know, particularly on a relative basis, it's been a strong absolute performer. But if you were to overlay the other house builder share price charts, this has kind of gone the other way and really bucked the trend, as you say. Still at a discount to NAV, probably near a 0.9 times now, 0.85. But you know, NAV's about £1.48 per share. But given what's going on and why the shares have woken up, this could even trade at a premium and become a bit of a compounder. And that is because of what is going on in the Scottish Highlands, where these guys have that land bank with planning permission. There is two absolutely ginormous infrastructure projects going on. The Scottish Freeport and the Green Power Line. Both are going to require tens of thousands of workers for many, many years to deliver on that. And there are, I don't know if you've been on holiday to Inverness, there are not many hotels. There is certainly not some kind of tourist destination hub that could cater for thousands of construction workers for years. So what's starting to be revealed, and Scottish Southern Energy, who are the big funder of these projects, they raised £33 billion, this is in the public domain, a listed company, it's definitely the public domain, £33 billion recently to fund this work. And I know some of the listeners are, you know, quite like to be sort of stock sleuths and do their homework themselves. This is a great one for that, because you can really dig around the Scottish Southern commentary and slide deck and sort of overlay where they talk about where their projects are with where Springfield's land bank is. And you can start to map out. And they've even got, there's a Gantt chart, I think, slide, is it slide 33? Or is that number just in my head from the, I think it might be slide 35. And you can, they timeline where they, when they're going to put spades in the ground where. And you can recognize names of these parcels and link them up to the ones Springer's own. And I think that's what's shot the shares off with a bit of a starting gun. Because we've been talking about this opportunity, you know, on forums like this, in our report accounts, in our fact sheets for some time. But all of a sudden, I think the market's believing it, understanding it, and repricing it. Real hats off to the business for capitalizing and pivoting into this opportunity quickly. They've really basically exited all other parts of Scotland, been selling down land. We're encouraging them to do more of that. They've been selling the land at a premium to book value, 1.2, 1.3 times. If you applied that to the share price, that gets you up nearer £2. So this is one that could really, it's almost sort of imminent more news there should be on the Scottish Southern projects, because in their slide deck, it kind of is like a little spade emoji, and it's January. So let's see. Could be a star performer in the coming months and next year, as you get that re-rating to NAV, and then perhaps a bit of a premium for some of the excitement. And the excitement comes from, you know, they own the land and they're a house builder. Scottish Southern need houses near the sites where Springfield owns the land very quickly for lots of people. So, yeah, it's a very strong bargaining position for Springfield, where we think there'll be super normal house building profit opportunities, because the thing we think will happen is, and there are some sort of pilots going on, which has given us confidence that this is correct and our work is right. We think Scottish Southern will pay Springfield up front some money to build the house, then rent it off them, and then they don't need the houses anymore. So there'll be some kind of exit deal where, well, everyone knows SSC are a full seller. So there's some quite attractive dynamics. It's going to be a long journey, and that value will come out over time. But as a sort of tuck it away type share for the long term and not have to worry about too much from here. Yeah, and that's how we thought about it. Really, really compelling. And, you know, delighted to again see us, you know, they are by far the smallest house builder on the London market. Market cap's about 100, 120, outperforming the big boys. That's what our fund is all about. Small little world beaters, or in this case, island beaters, you know, and that's why people invest in small caps. That's supposed to be the whole proposition. They can outperform, they can muscle their way in, they can have operational gearing and share prices to match.
Yeah. Just in terms of that infrastructure, when they partner with, say, you know, Scottish Southern, you know, the electricity providers or the Freeport, etc., do they need to raise any money at all alongside the cash they're going to get in? Because if they're going to rent it out to the infrastructure guys for 4 years and then sell it on, there is going to be a working capital requirement there, isn't it, to build it and then to finance it and stuff like that?
We think so. And we think there'll be a blend. We think Scottish Southern, you know, part of that $33 billion will probably be some upfront payments to Springers to underpin or give some sort of asset to then get some working capital lending alongside. I would look really closely at the CV of the Ned that joined Springfield earlier this year. An ex-banker has worked at all the major Scottish banks. Well, this is a kind of national rejuvenation flagship infrastructure project. I think you'll see, I think there'll be a queue of Scottish banks wanting to work on this with Springfield and build out. You may even see it form some kind of, I don't know, some kind of JV or structure. But all I know is that at the kind of layperson's level, Springers are in the prime position to name some good terms. What they will be, I just don't know, but it's definitely worth more than NAV.
Yeah, that would be lovely, actually, if they set up some sort of like joint venture where they're a, you know, sort of 25-30% holder. They provide, they do all the work, all the expertise, sell the land into it, and then effectively they're not responsible to do all the funding that's off balance sheet, but they get all the profits coming in. That would be a fabulous deal, actually. That would be really, really well.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's one that's taken time, but really starting to feel the rewards.
Okay, good. Let's go to a retailer that's absolutely been shooting the lights out, Angling Direct. I know you've talked about this quite a lot. They came out with some results which were like double-digit like-for-like growth in a retail environment, which is extremely sort of like, you know, challenging. What's been sort of driving that growth, and is it sustainable?
It's two things. The management, and we'll come back to them in a minute, huge credit to Steve Crow, Sam Copeman, the FD, and Andy Torrance, the chair, who was the CEO. And it's the market. Retail is hard, but as we've always said with this one, if you're ever going to play retail, and we don't very often, fishing tackles are not a bad place to start because of who the consumer is. They have disposable income, certainly more so than the national average. It's a hobby. It's a pastime. Those are all things to like. The performance has been exceptionally impressive. It's in that bucket of parallel universe stocks where, you know, they've again had to wear, you know, about a million of cost increases from the NI and national living wage changes. Well, that's 20% of Angling Direct's EBITDA. They have upgraded this year. I think in October they said it will be at least a new number. And we think actually they could beat that again in January when they hit their year end, because there's been, you know, there's been some healthy rain for the rivers, which I think we think would have driven the anglers out again. So to delivering one or maybe even two upgrades this year with that, yeah, it's proper hats, or I don't know if it's caps anglers wear or whatever, fly fishing hats off, because that, yeah, I would press anyone to find a retailer delivering like that. So super well done. I think from us as a team perspective, what's been nice, this was our first big call. It was our first core position. I think at times people didn't really get excited about the investment or get why we were investing. Is it a value trap? You just bought a cash pile. I'm very happy to buy a cash pile at a discount, but of course it was much more than that. And the share returns have been exciting. And actually the business is getting a lot more exciting than it was. Some of the reasons why it's outperforming, why the like-for-likes are so strong, is the initiatives of the management. And just a couple of examples that I'd encourage people to track, check in, pop down to one if you're a really keen shareholder or, you know, stock sleuth, is, you know, so first of all, MyAD. So their loyalty app, every time we come on, it's gone up quite a lot. So it was launched probably 2 years ago now. It's got 500,000 members. That's a quick rate of growth. That's a large number. It creates a stickiness and a data set on the customer base, which is allowing them to sell and price much better and push their own brands, which are much higher margin. So that's been a real win. Another has been Shop the Range, which is the cool way of describing it. I rather clunkily refer to it as Argos catalogs and iPads. So what you can do now in any Angling Direct stock, one of the problems or challenges the businesses used to face was it at 30,000 SKUs? You can't really get those all into a kind of store. Shop the Range is an iPad containing the entire range, a bit like you used to get an Argos catalog back in the day. And the business will promise to get you next day into the store, whatever it is you want from the range if it's not in store. And that's definitely driven both some increase in sort of transaction value, increase in wallet share. It's just another reason to go to their store rather than others or shop online. And then on those are sort of customer facing. I think on the margins and looking up the supply chain, you know, they have been cementing their market position. They've been growing, rolling out stores. That growing market share, as we've always talked about and hoped, is becoming, you know, a pretty big hook to take to the suppliers who at the moment make loads of money. They're sort of 60% gross margin businesses, Fox, Corda, Nash, and they're all private equity owned. They make things in the Far East and sell them around the world, and they have all the pricing power and a very low cost base. They're just having a bit of a dance now and just luring some of that margin back AD's way, because they can now say, well, the UK market's one of your favorites and we're starting to hold sway over it. So that's been a great initiative and a brave one. We think they'll probably benefit from some FX next year. So they buy their stock kind of now for the upcoming spring summer season, and it's dollar denominated. Well, the dollar's, you know, a lot more attractive to them as dollar purchasers, sterling sellers, than it was this time last year. So we think that'll be a bit of a tailwind. They're getting on with it. And you have to take your hat off to management like that. And, you know, one day Angling Direct will probably be part of some sort of retail empire. And until it is, we're highly supportive of the team. But, you know, Steve and Sam will want to work with them again, because what they've done here is real kind of, not alchemy, that's a bit over the top, but they've done a really good job in the most horrendous of trading environments. I think retail's the toughest it's ever been.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I mean, to get basically like-for-like sales growth of well over 10% in a really tough environment is absolutely top draw. In terms of the margins, it's doing about 3%, and that's always been the Achilles heel on the investment thesis. But what you're saying then is that as they increase their market share and grow, you should see that operating leverage come through. And if that does happen, where will be sort of like the sustainable EBIT margins? Is this a sort of 5% EBIT margin business, or is this a sort of like a nearer 10% EBIT margin business?
So from the three today, we see about two coming from gross margin increases dropping straight through. And then another 1% taking to 6 from really the business continuing to grow. It's about 100 of turnover today, doing about 6 of pre-IFRS EBITDA, 3 after. We see a path over the next 5 years to that sales number going to 130 or 140, and they're just being some inherent overhead offset within that to just get that extra 1%. And then you're a kind of, you know, 6% on 140. You're starting to, that's quite a meaningful EBITDA number. And certainly, yeah, this was a loss-making business 3 years ago. And so, again, hats off. Because if anything, the trading conditions have probably got worse than when they were in 2022.
Well, also hats off to you guys for spotting it, because I had a good look at it. And I must admit, I was always put off by the margin. So well done. And obviously, the management team has done a great job. Okay, we've got a final question. We've got David. He's asking about flooring and carpet distributor Likewise, which is on a mission to knock its big competitor Headlam out of the market, and seems to be doing a good job. The shares, though, did sort of like have a step backwards about a month ago when they had a profit warning, even though the sales were going to the moon. How do you see this one tracking?
So I think I described Tony Brewer, the chief executive, as the Alan Shearer of carpets when we last spoke. Well, they slightly kicked the ball out to touch and missed a chance to score recently. You're right. They've had a 25-30% profits downgrade. That was frustrating because I think they would probably been slightly too ambitious. So what they didn't do was, again, it's in this parallel universe bucket of stocks, they didn't adjust their numbers when the national insurance increases were put through. they felt they could trade their way beyond it. So that, i.e., they were coming ahead on turnover, but in line on the original profit forecast. And that's because they were having a record time of it. So whilst the growth numbers are still good for the year, they're actually sort of blowing the lights out over the summer. You can see that in what the share price was starting to do. And then what has happened is the delayed budget has just seen, you know, a big driver of activity here is RMI, house spend and moving houses. Both have dried up, as we all know. And that's just meant they couldn't sort of put the track down quick enough to outpace this wretched government. So frustrating. But the trade-off is, of course, that, you know, yes, it would be nice if Likewise had done 4 million of profit this year rather than the 3 it's going to do now. But the real price here and the reason you own the stock is because if you think it can basically outcompete and therefore destroy or certainly break down Headlam, which has been happening, by the way. Another torrid announcement from them. They're definitely not having record summers and growing at 10%. They're actually contracting, I think, and they're losing about 40 million per annum. They're running out of assets to sell. We are aware of assets they are selling. As a like, again, one for the stock sleuths, you can go and find some of their sites online for sale. They are running out of things to sell. And I think I even described the thesis this way on the last podcast. I certainly have to someone. So there's two scenarios for Likewise. The market stays bad and that kills Headlam off, combined with Likewise's pincer movement. And you get this massive mop up of market share. Headlam sales are significantly north of Likewise's, even though Likewise now has a larger market cap for the first time ever. When Tony Brewer, the amateur of carpets, when he left Headlam, it was £500 million company he'd built up over 20 years. Market cap's 50 today, I think, roughly. 9 years after he left later on. So if the market stays tough, Headlam will probably not survive. And that's just, you just go and look at the balance sheet. There's not a stock tip. It's not a recommendation. It's clearly, they've got restructuring consultants in, and that tends to be the kind of last desperate dash. Okay, so that's great for Likewise. Although, you know, difficult trading near term, but they've got a bulletproof balance sheet and a real shareholder support. The alternative is all of a sudden they wave the wand, some sort of stamp duty cut or something, and transactions of housing go to the moon, volumes pick up, the market picks up. It's probably a stay of execution for Headlam near term. We still think Likewise is going to cannibalize their market share, and it is, but a stay of execution. But of course, that much improved market opportunity would be great for Likewise's sales and profits. And almost a bit like Angling Direct, back when we first flagged it at 24p, that was a different strategic optionality. That was to do with the European business. But it was a kind of either way you can make money type situation. And we see this with Likewise. Either the market picks up and they trade well, or the market stays tough and they're the last man standing and you clean up on the way out because the competitors have fallen away. And that's how we see Likewise. So it's difficult business to value from that perspective because you won't find that in the multiple. That's a judgment call through due diligence and market analysis, which we've done, as you'd expect, quite a bit of. But we like this. It's a bit quirky in terms of, you know, would I traditionally want to go into a lower margin, sort of old tired industry like flooring, distributing the carpets? I don't know, but you usually say something about retail, and Angling Direct's worked out really well for us, and we have a similar returns thesis here.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're betting on the management, aren't you? What they've done in the track record. There is a third scenario where Headlam decide to actually start fighting properly, and they get into a bit of a price war, and they do somehow manage to scrape a few pennies together to be able to fund it, and then you get a bit of a race to the bottom before something structurally happens in the market. Is that a potential risk at all if Headlam did decide to sort of like become more price competitive?
I think the fact they're losing 40 million on a kind of, I think it's a 300 million turnover number, a margin of minus 10%, tells you they're already trying to do that because it used to be a profitable business. Right. And Likewise is making profits of 3 on sales of 150 or something. So it's just quite a big spread. So they're definitely pricing lower than Likewise. So we think that's already happening, and Likewise are weathering it. And actually, there is probably some margin upside in Likewise, not just turnover from if Headlam fall away, because they may have slightly better. They won't have to be combating that. They also just haven't got a balance sheet to lose any more money, Headlam. I mean, it's really stretched. And look, there may be some sort of rescue raise. What do you?
It'll be certainly quite amusing if Tony decides to put the slider all over Headlam and buy him now because he's got a bigger market cap. But that might be hit by the competition authorities, I suppose. But
my suspicion is that that call's already been made, and it's a thanks but no thanks. We're just going to watch you wither. Tony is on a bit of a mission. I think it's got to get break even before anyone's going to put more money into it. And I don't know, 40 million is a long way off from that. Let's see.
Okay, good. All right, well, we're coming to the end of the interview. Now, I've got one final question then. Obviously, we started off what your outlook for equities for the next 12 months, but now I'd like to sort of like, what's sort of like your favourite stock idea? And it is underlined idea and emboldened that it's no advice at all for 2026.
So I'm not going to call it a stock tip for that reason, but some of our highest conviction ideas in the context of what we talked about today. So businesses that are global earners, not just UK earners, are cheap, and most crucially have some catalysts to almost drive value independently would be, I think Pebble Beach Systems is really nicely sat at a great valuation, master of its own destiny from here under a new chair. And then Mincon, I think as well, it's just really well set from an end markets perspective, from a catalysts perspective. And then a more speculative one, which there's a lot of execution to be done, and we've not had a chance to talk about it today, would be Rent Guarantor Holdings, which most times in my career, I meet a company and I think the share price is interesting. But this is one where we left and just thought, that's a, excuse my French, bloody good idea. So that's one to watch in the new year. We are holders just in terms of transparency. And we'll write up about it in our Q4 fact sheet. We put quite a lot of money in at 12.5p per share recently in a deal we structured. And they're sort of trading at 30 today. So definitely not a tip, but one to watch. It's all down to execution. But if they execute, this is a really exciting business model, very timely with the renters' rights bill. All of a sudden, landlords are going to need what they do pretty desperately, and they've got some really nice first mover advantage and a moat with their partnership with Aviva for the underwriting. So let's just see what happens there.
Yeah, what's the investment thesis? Because there are about 40, I've got about 45 million market cap, but the turnover is still only around about 2 or 3. Is that correct?
Correct. Well, you've sort of extrapolated there why we insisted on a 12p fundraising price in the chair for 30 on the screen. Look, there's definitely some excitement about what this business could be worth. So the guarantors, which is a US equivalent, literally this morning or yesterday, has put it up for sale for $500 million at 3x sales. This concept of rent guarantees, professional rent guarantees, is very new to the UK market, but all of a sudden could be required in large scale because the renters' rights bill has made it much harder to evict a renter that defaults on the rent or goes into arrears. You can't now, one of the ways around it was to charge 6 months rent or something up front. That's illegal now. And I think increasingly the bank of mum and dad doesn't want to sign up for a rent guarantee themselves because they've got their own, frankly, bills to pay. It, as I say, it's got to execute. It's got to grow into its valuation, got to grow into its opportunity. But just one you meet and a really good idea. And as I say, at 12p, we've done that at sort of 3x next year's sales number, but it's a very tiny number. It could, what's changing is, until now, the business has had to kind of sell to consumers directly, B2C, one ticket at a time, one renter. The renter's rights bill all of a sudden has got the landlords and the landlord's advisors wanting a solution. So rather than having to win one tenant at a time, you might win a landlord of 3,000 estates in one go who says, I want this I want this deployed on my entire property estate. And to that effect, I think in the past 2 weeks alone, they've announced there's now a preferred supplier to Winkworth and they've partnered with JLL. And there could be more like things like this because the industry has got a problem. And it could, the growth could, just from, because it's the law of small numbers, there's just a wide range of outcomes. So one to track, have a look at, monitor for sure.
Yeah. So basically their investment thesis is that they offer guaranteed payments of rent from tenants to the landlords, and it could work for the tenants, and it looks as though they're going to get the massive growth from the actual landlords who insist because they're not be able to get that deposit up front. So
that's the change because, as I say, they've now been able to win one customer at a time. I think they've got 4,000 renters on the books at the moment, about £700 per customer per year. So that gives you a turnover of about 4.5 for next year. But, you know, we know landlords ourselves that we're now introducing that own 3,000 properties, 10,000 properties or more. And if they start to fold that in, it's almost like overnight chunks of growth. So let's see, everyone that we introduced to in the sector so far is very impressed. The referencing is very strong in the industry. Mm. But yeah, the one to watch is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Isn't it easy to copy though? I'll just think, because it's just financing, isn't it? Basically,
no. It's financing. You've got to have the relationships with the insurers, i.e., the underwriters, of which they have three now. You can't just get those overnight. That's something that's got to be set up. But that's why we've given them some money to capitalize on that first mover advantage, because we think there will be ultimately two or three players. But if RGG can be one of them, it's a very large market with unit economics that are very, very compelling. And that's really why we've taken a bit of a view in the nursery for Onward on this one.
Yeah. Well, I must admit, you've done pretty well on your last 2 years, top tips with Winwood and Audio Boom. So I strongly suggest investors have a good look through all of those companies, and particularly the last three. So hope you have a great Christmas, Laurie, and really well done with all the returns. I mean, you know, your investment vehicle, your trust has done fabulously compared to the rest of the small cap market. So keep up the great work, and we'll chat in the new year. So thanks again.
You too, Paul, and thank you so much for having us on today.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.